Hi, this is Colin McCallan. Thank you for listening. Please do us a favor and leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. Thank you.
Welcome to Is This Legal? Here are your hosts, attorneys Colin McCallan and Russell Hebbets.
All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever this podcast finds you in the world. My name is Colin McCallan, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Russell Hebbets.
Hello, hello, everyone.
Where are my true crime peeps at? Raise your hand. We've got a treat for you today. We are going to get into a pretty juicy serial killer case that has come out of New York, specifically Gilgo Beach, Long Island. Right, Russ?
That's right.
Yeah. So there was an arrest that was just made last week in this case. A fella by the name of Rex Huerman, age 59, a New York City architect, Russ. Married man, father of two.
Has his own architecture firm.
Yeah, exactly. He is apparently a closet serial killer. Obviously, he's alleged to have committed right. these offenses, but he was just arrested for 3 counts of first-degree murder. And again, this relates to some unsolved killings of women who were known to be female escorts in the Long Beach area. These killings spread a time span of around 2007 to 2010.
Yeah, big old time frame, and very cold cases. Like, we're talking about the last remains were found in 2010. So these cases have been unsolved for quite a long time.
Yeah, and so we are at the very beginning, legal stages for Mr. Huerman. He has just been arrested, just been charged. We still don't have a ton of information related to discovery. We don't have a preliminary hearing set yet. I think his next court date is coming up on August 1st here, though, so we'll probably know some more information then.
But we have a fair amount of information on how the authorities zeroed in on Mr. Huerman and how they eventually got warrants and arrested him.
Yeah, exactly. And if for those of you who have followed our coverage on Brian Koberger, we spent a couple of episodes breaking down the methods that law enforcement used in order to track their killer. And in this case, too, Russ, it is equally as fascinating, the technological advances that they used to uncover this man's identity. They span several years. It's pretty amazing, and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what law enforcement is able to do now with advancements in technology, primarily DNA technology, really. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. That's a huge thing. But also, like we talked about in the Koberger case. By the way, Colin, he's an alleged killer,
right.
Koberger, still.
Yep.
Both these guys are still allegation. There have been no jury verdicts, no pleas.
Yeah, we are defense attorneys, after all.
Yeah, and Mr. Huerman has pled not guilty.
And he's also stated through his lawyer, who's communicated to the press, that he didn't do this. He's planning on, clearing his name here.
And we'll lay out the information and let you guys form your own initial opinions, not court of law opinions, because that's beyond a reasonable doubt, but your opinions. But it's very interesting how much more can be done today than could have been done just a mere 10 years ago.
Right. And, again, kind of making a contrast between Koberger and this guy here, Huerman. Oh, I'm going to butcher his name probably.
Huerman. It's fun to say.
Yeah, it is.
Huerman.
But there are a lot of parallels in terms of, you mentioned DNA. That was definitely one tool that right. investigators used. Cell phone technology, right. that, Russ, has come a long way in terms of how they can track not only cell phones, but how burner phones can be, you can trace their location even years after the fact. We're going to get into it. Why don't we start? And again, let's start at the beginning. Just last Thursday, July 13th, Rex Huerman gets arrested in New York City for 3 accounts of murder. And so let's go backward and figure out how we got there.
How about that? I was going to say, you're starting at the end, not at the beginning.
I guess I'm starting at the end. I just spoiled the
intro.
Ending.
You did. Now everyone knows.
But we spoiled it anyway. So now we'll go back to the beginning. Okay. So This actually starts, ironically, during a missing persons search of a person that may be completely unrelated to this group of killings that we're talking about. A woman by the name of Shannon Gilbert was a 23-year-old from Jersey City, New Jersey, who had not been seen since May of 2010. While authorities are looking for Shannon Gilbert's remains in December of 2010, specifically December 11th, they find the remains of a person named Melissa Barthelemy, a 24-year-old escort who went missing sometime in the late 2000s, the late 2009, 2010. 2 days after finding her body, Russ, yeah. Investigators find the remains of three additional victims. Their names are Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Amber Costello, and Megan Waterman.
And those four bodies make up the Gilgo Beach Four.
That was the nickname given to these four bodies that were found. And, you know, the reason that the investigators believe that there was a link in the killings is because some of the bodies were actually wrapped together in a same camouflage burlap kind of wrap. And all four of these women were escorts that had advertised their services on Craigslist between July 2007 and September 2010.
So, I mean, here's just like factual confirmation. Anyone out there who's really worried about listing things on Craigslist, I mean, be worried, right? Although, I mean, I figure maybe selling an old skateboard might be a little different than escort service.
Right.
Yeah.
Might be. I think Craigslist is still a pretty good way to get rid of some stuff.
Just do the exchange at the police station and you're going to be okay.
Hey, safety first, right? Now, Russ, it's really weird. This is where kind of things, I think, get really weird. They start finding, over the course, law enforcement starts finding the remains of 10 people total strewn across this beach area. I mean, not all together. And honestly, it is unclear whether or not any of these additional victims are tied to Huerman or not. But for example, on April 4th of 2011, so this is just 4 months after the four victims were found,
yep.
Three more sets of remains are found, including a toddler, an unidentified Asian man, and another woman. And then a week after that, they find two additional sets of human remains in Nassau County, which is about 40 miles east of New York City. And one of the bodies was identified as the mother of the toddler that was found on the beach.
So here's what I really am struggling with. Like, you're talking about this beach. This beach is on Long Island. Long Island is not known to be sparsely populated.
Right.
Like, how are all of these corpses, these bodies, not being discovered for over a decade on the beach where, like, I would imagine the whole beach is developed? Like, I don't understand it.
This reminds me back to the movie The Usual Suspects, where the bad guys are burying one of their counterparts who has his demise, and they're digging a hole in the beach to bury this guy. And they're all joking, like, there's no way this guy is going to remain here.
Right.
You know, marine life is going to eat him up. Like, the sand is going to wash away.
Toddlers are going to dig him up building pits.
Well, right? It obviously took several years, but eventually these remains were discovered.
I mean, this camouflage that he used, these camouflage sacks, that must have been like incredible camouflage.
Well, is it just beige? it's just in sand, right? And like, are they army colored? Could that have actually stood out? I mean, like, who uses camouflage when you're burying in the sand? I don't know. I mean, obviously it didn't work, right? We know that burying your body in the sand is not a reliable way of disposing of a body.
It's good for a decade, and yeah. That's about it.
Which apparently was not long enough. Allegedly, we'll see. Now, Russ, let's get to one of the, I guess, more grisly parts of this case, which is, I mentioned one of the women who went missing was Melissa Barthelemy. She was a 24-year-old escort. After she went missing, her family members started receiving phone calls from her phone. and they would be like minute-long calls from the killer.
That's unbelievable.
And the killer, the caller who had her phone, is saying things like, just so you know, you're not going to ever find her body. I killed her. He said a lot worse things than I'm not going to go into to our sensitive ears out there.
Details about molesting her.
Yeah, details about what he did before killing her, which were very grisly. He's talking to this girl's sister about these things. These phone calls were all brief. They were all made from burner phones. Now, I mentioned at the top of the podcast, Russ, that these burner phones might be important. This guy's hubris may have contributed to his undoing.
I mean, it for sure did. And for anyone out there who doesn't know, burner phones are these phones you can just buy at like convenience stores. They are not registered. You don't have to sign up for them. So they're essentially untraceable.
Right. And this is actually my apology. We're going to get to the burner phones in a minute. But going back specifically to this victim's cell phone, again, this is a cell phone. We know about this phone.
Right.
And law enforcement is able to go back through records and figure out where that phone is being used. So after this woman's disappearance, if they want to find out about this phone, what are they going to do? They're going to start using cell phone ping tower data. We've talked about this on other podcasts. We certainly talked about it at length in the Koberger podcast, but this is essentially a way where you can triangulate a phone's position when it is used to make a phone call.
You can track it. You know the general area where that phone is.
Right.
And the authorities use that information in conjunction with the burner phone information to figure out. They know generally where the person was when they were making these calls.
Right.
They tracked her phone so they could see where she was before her demise, before her disappearance.
Right.
And, you know, things started to match up for authorities.
So they could use Bartholomew, the first victim. They found that her phone had been making these calls, these taunting calls from Midtown Manhattan.
So not only was her phone useful after the fact, but
with these taunting calls,
with these taunting calls, but they were able to go back and get data from her phone on the date of the offense. And here's what they found. They found that her phone was communicating with one of these burner phones. Now, they don't know who it was registered to because it's a burner phone, but it was talking to a burner phone, and the burner phone was in Massapequa Park.
Right. Okay. Let's tell our listeners, a burner phone, I think you probably know what we're talking about. This is a phone that's basically unregistered, untraceable. Sometimes burner phones are used by criminals to disguise what they're doing, by drug dealers, things like that. If you don't want to be tracked, you're going to use a burner phone.
Yeah, you can buy it at a cricket store, at a gas station, right? And you don't have to sign up for anything.
Exactly.
It's just prepaid.
Exactly.
So what they saw is she's talking to this burner phone in Massapequa Park. They can see the burner phone comes to Midtown and Manhattan, and they can see that her phone goes to Massapequa Park.
Okay. And we should interject one thing here. I mean, we are dealing with a case where there's still not a ton of physical evidence with regard to Hireman. They're searching his phone. They're combing over all of his stuff as we speak right now. This case is still in its infancy. But investigators have told the press that they do believe that he, I guess, enacted the killings at his house, that these murders took place at his house in a controlled environment. They found a lot of things in his house that would have been consistent with possible body disposal, things like that. But in terms of where these murders occurred, they happened at his house. And that's what makes this Massapequa address important, is because it shows she could have been in the area where he was when she died.
Right. It shows her phone was in the area where he was. Can't say she was at his house, but it can say she was at the cell tower closest to his house.
Right. So that's just the beginning, though. I think maybe now is a good time to take a break, Russ, to play a little Is This Legal with our listeners. But then on the other side, we'll get into more about this investigation, more about how they track this man down, and more about what's next for old Rex Hireman here.
Let's do it.
All right, we'll be right back after the break.
Welcome back, everyone. We are now going to play an episode of Is This Legal?
I do not know. That's what's so fun about this game.
No one knows yet.
Well, we do.
Well, that's true. No one out there listening. And that's who we're playing with. You, the listener.
That's right.
So for this episode, we return to the humble hamlet of Northamptonshire to find Jebediah in a temporary and uncharacteristic phase of exhibiting law-abiding conduct.
All right. Good for Jebediah.
That's right, Colin. And you, listener, he's on the straight and narrow for now. Now, Jebediah decides he's going to throw a party in his shack in an effort to market his wagon wheel repair shop. He's really trying to grow his business legitimately.
Yep. Get away from the moonshine. I get it.
Right. So after debating the topic with himself a great deal, he decides he's going to go ahead and bury the hatchet and invite Officer Cornelius to the party. Now, Officer Cornelius, once he receives that invitation, he also debates with himself whether he should accept that buried hatchet or dig it up and wield it against Jebediah.
Yeah, a lot of bad blood between those two.
Ultimately, Officer Cornelius says, I'm going to go along with it. I'm going to go to the party. Now, he mostly decided that because he has absolutely no friends.
Of course.
Right. But nonetheless, even though the moonshine isn't flowing, everybody at the party has a great time. At the end of the night, Officer Cornelius thanks Jebediah for the invite and for being a great host. But as he's stepping out of the shack, Cornelius trips on a loose horseshoe on the steps and falls to the ground, breaking his arm.
Oh.
Jebediah runs over immediately, and not wanting trouble with either Cornelius or bad press, he says, I'm so sorry, Cornelius. I'm so sorry the horseshoe was on the ground. I'm willing to give you $200 to take care of your medical treatment.
Couple of Benjamins.
Cornelius refuses the offer. He later hires a lawyer and sues Jebediah for negligence. Jebediah denies the claim and decides to fight the case. It proceeds to trial. At trial, Cornelius's lawyer attempts to admit evidence of Jebediah's offer to pay that $200 in order to prove that Jebediah was liable for negligence. Jebediah's lawyer and sometimes girlfriend Myrtle objects, arguing the evidence of the offer should be excluded from trial and can't be used to prove negligence. Hmm. The question for you out there in podcast land, what should the judge do?
I mean, what should you, the judge, do? You go ahead and put on your black robe that you've got in your closet there. Go ahead and grab that hammer that you've got in the garage for a gavel.
Put on your white wig.
Put on your powdered wig. Make sure powder it's powdered, you know. And get up on that stool and start just banging the hell out of your desk. And court is in session.
Make a ruling.
Yeah. And what is that ruling going to be in this case, Your Honor?
I changed
it. Have we been dramatic enough?
I changed it because I don't want to get sued by Jeopardy.
So, guess what? Myrtle, she's just such a sharp witch. She's right again.
Yes.
Rule 409 of the Federal Rules of Evidence is going to keep that out. And you may be thinking, wait, whoa, what? What? His offer to settle, his offer to pay $200 is going to somehow not be relevant in this case? Russ, tell him why.
It is not relevant because you don't want to, the court system, America doesn't want to discourage settlements.
Right.
Right? So you don't want to discourage people from actually taking care of damages and resolving cases. So if that stuff were to come in, everyone would just say, I'm not saying a word. I'm not giving you anything. You know, I'll see you in court because it's going to be used against me if I try to make this right.
Exactly. And, you know, if you paid really close attention to Russ as he was reading the hypothetical.
Which they obviously did.
You will know that Russ indicated that evidence was being offered in order to show that Jebediah was negligent. You cannot use it for that prohibited use. It doesn't go toward whether or not he was negligent. So, like Russ said, that evidence is going to be suppressed. The jury should not hear about that offer to pay. And by the way, conversely, he offered to pay $200. That doesn't mean that Jebediah or that Cornelius can say, see, my claim is worth $200 because that's what he was going to pay me. Basically, all aspects of that settlement offer are going to stay out of court.
Right. And also, I mean, he probably should have gone higher than 200 in the first place, if I'm being honest.
I was kind of adjusting for inflation back in the old days when they were having wagon wheel. I figured $200 would be like worth $4 million now.
They have multi cars.
Well, barely though. Like it's a new thing. It's like, you know.
Yeah, I'm not buying it. But anyway, no matter what, we're not going to let you know how the case came out because we didn't write that.
But we at least know that Jebediah is at least the winner here.
Yes. You know, winner, Jebediah dinner.
And poor Cornelius. I think he's regretting going to that party, and he's probably going to be pissed at Jebediah again and start drudging up a bunch of charges against him.
As we'd expect.
Well, I guess we'll find out as this saga continues. All right, well, that's enough. Is this legal for right now? We're going to go back to our regularly scheduled programming. Stay tuned. Welcome back, folks, to our regularly scheduled programming. We're going to be continuing our discussion on Rex Heyerman, an alleged serial killer that was just discovered out of New York. Before the break, we were kind of talking about what the police were finding in 2010 and 2011, including the human remains that were found along this long stretch of beach, as well as some of the forensic evidence that law enforcement had. But Russ, this case in like beginning of 2011 went cold for a long time, didn't it?
It went cold for a long time. Like they were trying to still periodically try to solve it. Like in 2020, they identified another body. They used DNA to help identify these people.
And they used a procedure in this 2020 identification that used technology that we didn't have a decade earlier.
Correct.
To find out who the identity of these victims were. Because again, these are decomposed remains.
Right. And these are people who had been, you know, this in May 28th of 2020, they finally identified Jane Doe number 6, who went missing 2 decades earlier.
Wow.
So we're talking about a long time frame. So it wasn't until February of 2022 that the Suffolk County Police Commissioner, Rodney Harrison, he formed a multi-agency task force to investigate these beach killings. Okay, so that included his sheriff's office, New York State Patrol, and the FBI.
That's right.
So at that point, you now have some big hitter police agencies that are really trying to solve this.
And you also got the full power of all of these law enforcement agencies using up-to-date technology to basically go through and reprocess old forensic evidence that they've had, in this case, for over a decade.
Right.
Well, they got pretty quick results. Russ, you said this task force was formed in February 2022. On March 14th, 2022, within a month, Rex Heyerman was first mentioned as a possible suspect in the Gilgo Beach murder cases after a New York State investigator identified him in a database, according to the Suffolk County DA, Ray Tierney. This is the very, very first time we have a name associated with these killings. So, Russ, did they just go in and arrest the guy right away? And
they much like the Koberger law enforcement, they wanted to get as much evidence as they can. They wanted to do it right. Jump the gun. So they basically started a long campaign of surveillance. What they did, they impaneled a grand jury. They started getting warrants, search warrants. So they are now honing in on him, and they are following him, they are surveilling him, and they are doing trash dumps.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, once they have the identity of a suspect, that opens the door to so many different investigative avenues, right? I mean, they can start looking at his cell phone records.
Right.
They can start piecing together, it's largely based on even public information, where he works, his whereabouts take him. They started physically surveilling him, Russ. They would actually follow him from his home in Long Island to his workplace in Manhattan.
And it's super interesting what they did. You know, a lot of this began with that cell phone data we're talking about, because they start with thousands of cell phones that were hitting these towers. Then they're just narrowing them down. And every time they narrowed down the cell phones, Heuermann or Heuermann, I don't know how you say it, it was still in the picture, right? And then what they did is they took witness statements, because there was a witness for one of these killings that actually saw the alleged killer, and he saw a general physical description and what vehicle that person got into.
He was described as a 6'4 or 6'5 ogre looking person. But he was very big in stature, and you know, he's also a pretty big guy. This is a large man they're looking for.
Right.
And Rex Heuermann is about 6'5", 240 pounds. He fits, and he kind of looks like an ogre.
Yeah.
Did you see his mugshot? I'm sorry.
I mean,
look, I'm not saying he's guilty, but if that's your mugshot, man,
he's certainly not handsome.
It looks like kind of a serial killer mugshot, if I might throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's
take
true.
A look, Google Heuermann mugshot, and you're going to see what I'm saying. The guy looks fairly sinister.
They also figured out that you know, the witness, this ogre, was seen getting into a green pickup truck.
Oh, let's talk about the green pickup truck, Russ. Yeah. So a green pickup truck, fairly unusual. I don't remember the last time I saw green pickup truck, unless it belonged to our buddy and sometimes listener to this podcast, Paul Doroshenko up in Canada. Hey, Paul, like your latest musical video, by the way. Pretty rare, right?
Pretty rare. And there's no green pickup truck registered to Rex Heuermann. So the police, though, didn't stop there.
No, they looked at his brother.
Yep.
His brother has a green pickup truck.
Yep.
And Heuermann had access to it.
Yep.
Around the times of these killings. So things are starting to fall into place, but we're not quite done yet, are we, Russ?
No, I'll tell you one other thing law enforcement did is they dug so deep, they looked at the travel plans of his wife and children, mm-hmm. and they found that when these disappearances happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the same times those disappearances happened, it turns out that Rex Heuermann's wife and children were out of town traveling.
And he would have been alone in his house for several days at a time.
Where these phones are ending up.
Now, okay, so they start doing this investigation. It finally becomes incumbent on law enforcement to attempt to get a DNA sample from Heuermann. And here's why, Russ, because they found unidentified pieces of DNA from hairs in these burlap sacks that these bodies were contained in. Russ, how do we go about getting some DNA? Remember in Koberger, they went and got his trash. How did they do it in this case?
Trash, ladies and gentlemen out there, trash is public, right? Trash is public. You have no constitutional right to privacy in trash.
Mm-hmm.
Once you throw it away, it is gone. That means that any law enforcement can go to do these trash dumps and just dig through and find the trash. And on January 23rd, that's exactly what
January 23rd of this year.
Yes, January 2023, investigators got a complete sample of Heuermann's DNA from a leftover crust in a pizza box that he threw in the trash.
In Midtown Manhattan as he's walking down the street. It's a good thing these guys were following him on foot, because, I mean, what a piece of evidence that they could have missed. I mean, this guy, he's apparently being very careful. I mean, I'm assuming, we don't know everything about this investigation. I'm assuming they sat on his trash dump for a long time and couldn't find any DNA. You know, maybe he was careful enough to try and not dispose of any DNA.
Right.
Okay. However, they did find his wife's DNA from some cleaning products bottles that they found in his trash. And guess what, Russ? Three of his wife's hairs were found in one of the burlap bags where remains were found on the beach. So three of his wife's hairs were found in one of these crime scenes.
Yeah, and what
of course
that,
you can link that to him.
Right, exactly. And that's the point. Like, law enforcement is not saying his wife had anything to do with it.
His wife has actually divorced him. I just found that out today. His wife filed for divorce.
probably a smart move.
I think she has good grounds.
whether or not he's going down, you probably don't want to try to weather that storm.
Your Honor, we've been having some communication difficulties and things have been kind of heading down south. And then I found out out he was a serial killer, and that was kind of what pushed me over the edge, Your Honor.
That's why I'm filing this, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I'm not asking for maintenance or child support. I don't know if he's going to have any income.
but those things put him, because obviously it's not unreasonable to say that you pick up some of your wife's hairs. I mean, I can tell you it's not uncommon for me to pull a hair off my shirt and be like, this is definitely not my hair. You know, this definitely belongs to my wife.
Right.
So
the shower is another fun area where you're going to find all kinds of nastiness, and let's just not even talk about it anymore.
Let's move on from the shower.
You know what I'm talking about, people.
But anyway, so now they have actual DNA linking him to the remains that were found, and that, I think, Colin, is when they actually said, yep, this is about enough, let's go ahead and get a warrant.
They finally did get a warrant, and they arrested him, because the DA actually said, look, we're afraid he's still operating, we're afraid he's still doing this. In fact, Russ, they looked at his Google searches. Want to know some of these colorful searches? So they found that he had performed over 200 searches recently before he had been nabbed related to this case. He had Googled the following terms: unsolved serial killer cases. He Googled many times each of the names of his victims. He Googled the following: why law enforcement could not trace the calls made by the Long Island serial killer.
Wow.
Again, he actually had much worse, much more nefarious searches that I'm not going to read out here for our young listeners who might be listening in. But damning stuff. It reminds me of that Brian Walsh guy, how to dispose of a body, you know, stuff that was found on his computer.
Right.
So they find these incriminating Google searches. They find that the time frames of the killings all match times where his wife and kids were out of town.
Right.
All of this stuff is starting to mount up. He has not made any statements, Russ, since his arrest, other than saying he didn't do anything. He's going to be pending trial. And of course, we will continue to watch this. One other note I saw as I was doing research for this podcast: you remember the BTK serial killer, Dennis Rader?
I don't.
Okay, so some of our listeners may know that. He was a serial killer who operated in the United States for many, many years. And he was a minister, he was a husband, he was a father, he blended into the community. And when he was caught, everybody was like, I can't believe it. Rader from prison has actually been commenting on Rex Huerman. He basically said, this guy's just like me. He was 59 years old when he was caught. I was 59 when I was caught. I had two kids. He has two kids. I was married. He was married. We operated in broad daylight in the secrecy of being in a community. So he's actually commenting, this serial killer, on the, proclivities of his fellow serial killer, Rex Huerman, allegedly.
It makes you really think that we have too many serial killers.
Yeah, like the fact that these guys are all talking about their work. And anyway. So I think we'll put a bow on it, Russ. That is what's going on with the Gilgo Beach serial killings. We're going to find out whether or not Mr. Huerman is going to be held accountable. That we're curious whether or not he's going to be tied to other killings. There are other active investigations going on.
So right now he's charged in three of the Gilgo Beach four. It sure looks like he's shortly going to be charged with the fourth. Mm-hmm. But like Colin said at the top of this podcast, there's at least 10 bodies have been found, and it's going to be interesting to see if they can link him with more of those. Frankly, hopefully. I mean, if he did this, which it sure is looking like he did, he hasn't been proven guilty, but it's sure looking like it, it would be good to know he's the only one out there doing this, mm-hmm. and that all of these are tied to him. And now that he's behind bars, then the people in that area can kind of breathe a little bigger sigh of relief and not worry about stumbling across camouflage bodies on the beach.
Right. And meanwhile, the Gilgo Beach tourism department is now hiring for help with marketing to Gilgo Beach.
Now body free. Terrible. Okay. Terrible.
Want to know if something else terrible or more like stupid, Russ? Are we ready to finish off with our best segment of the week?
Yes, I want to hear about another dumb criminal.
It is time for
DCOT.
W, Dumb Criminal of the Week time, folks. Here's your weekly dose of stupidity. And in this case, it's going to come from our good friends to the north, North Dakota.
Oh.
North Dakota. I don't think we've been there yet.
No, I mean, I don't think so. Fargo?
Are I will we tell you, I've never been to North Dakota, like, period. That's one of, like, the eight states I still haven't checked off.
Or South get up Dakota. There. It's nice and cold.
I that's what I hear. Yeah. I know. I hear if you like motorcycles and trees and mountains, that's...
Fun accents.
Yeah. It's a place to go. Well, here's what we got. Here's your DCOTW. A homeowner named John Jeffries was doing some yard work late one night, and he left his garage door open. He had his ATV in his garage, and unfortunately for John, he noticed that after leaving the garage door open, his ATV was missing. It was stolen. So he reported the theft of the ATV as well as a chainsaw that had been attached to the back of the ATV to the police. He also provided a very detailed description of the ATV to the police investigator. About 2 days later, Russ, the police contacted Jeffries, telling him that the thief may have posted the items on Craigslist. After seeing the post, Jeffries was 100% convinced that it was his ATV and chainsaw. And with the coordination of the police, John responded to the Craigslist ad and met up with our thief, our DCOTW, Shane Preheim. Russ, Preheim had both the ATV and chainsaw in his truck. Now, you might be wondering, Russ, and listener at home, how do we know? Why was John so sure that this was his ATV? Well, John knew it was his ATV because he placed a bumper sticker on the back of it that says, "Honk if your ex-wife sucks," after what I assume was a very pleasant and peaceful divorce.
Right.
So, Russ, this moron thief, after stealing the ATV, leaves the sticker on the ATV.
Wow.
So John paid Preheim for his items, and Preheim was immediately pulled over by the police at the next block, who returned the cash as well as the the stolen items had been already obtained by
they've been rebought
by the neighbor. So Preheim was charged with theft and burglary.
Yep.
So there you go, man. What do you think about that?
I feel like, you know, if I'm going to do that, I don't think there's any big communities in North Carolina or North Dakota. So, I mean, like, just posting it on Craigslist in what has to be a small community, like, the chances of getting caught have to be, like, close to 100%, right? Unless...
I mean, probably a lot of ATVs there. Probably very few with that specific bumper sticker,
right,
though.
Right.
I mean, talk about leaving your ex-wife behind.
I mean, like, would it have been that hard to just put a different bumper sticker over it? Like, I mean, at least that's something.
Or maybe
something.
Just take it off. Maybe.
Well,
maybe,
bumper stickers are tough to get
or
off.
Or maybe don't steal ATVs with chainsaws in the back of them in the first place.
Yeah.
I like the fact that he brought the chainsaw with him, though, where the guy was like, oh, yeah, that's my chainsaw.
I'll take the chainsaw, too. That's just added value. That's value add.
You know, the funny thing is, Russ, what I'm kind of wondering is whether or not the homeowner is going to get reunited with his ex-wife, because technically, the ex-wife is responsible for recovering the ATV.
Oh.
I mean, if he hadn't gotten that sticker, you know, if he hadn't been compelled to put that sticker on his ATV, he would have never gotten his ATV back. So I think we're going to just assume that everybody got reunited and lived happily ever after.
We'll do a follow-up on their reconciliation.
Absolutely. But meanwhile, we got knuckleheads from Mr. Preheim here. I mean, Russ, you go first.
I'm going to give him a 4.5. Mm. And I give him half off because although it shouldn't have been the toughest to steal it, he did initially get away with it.
Yeah, fair enough.
I give him half a knucklehead off, but then all your actions after that were so stupid.
Yeah,
that's where we're at.
And I've given a lot of fives, and today's going to be no different, Russ. Yeah. I mean, this guy stole an ATV with a very distinct picture on it and then tried to resell it to the person that he stole it from. Pretty amazing. And you know, sucks. It's just,
yeah.
I wonder how many honks the guy gets just riding around his ATV. Is just people just honking like crazy? Or
I feel like there's probably a fair amount of divorced people who are unhappy with their exes. Mm-hmm. And they're probably giving them some love.
There's an audience out
there's
there. You're
audience,
saying
that's All what right. I'm saying.
All right. Well, I think we'll end on that one. Looks like a 9.5 for our friend, Mr. Preheim. Pretty stupid. Okay, that's our 99th episode. Next one's the big 100. Listeners out there, we don't know what we're going to do yet for our 100th episode, but we'll be talking about it. If you guys would like to share your thoughts on our podcast, if you'd like to tell us what you think of the show, good or bad, email us at denvercrimelaw. You can at gmail.com. You can find us at Is This Legal Pod at Twitter. You can reach us at Facebook at Hebbets and McAllen. Russ, anything else?
Nothing else. Everyone, thanks for listening and be safe.
That's right. Bye-bye.
Johnny Law looked at me, said, Jebediah, can't you see? Them things you're doing just ain't right. Going around this town, stirring up a fright. Won't get far driving in your motor car. Look Cornelius right in the eye. Said you ain't got proof, I ain't the guy. Said I may not wear no crown upon my head. I may not be regal. Tell me one thing, Cornelius, my friend. Is it legal? Is it legal?